From the underground bunker of the Civitas Studio in Raleigh, North Carolina, it's Civitalk with your hosts, Brooke Medina and Ray Nothstein. We're here to connect culture with civics, making it relevant to your daily life. And dare we say, existence at a time where too many are triggered and offended. So, relax, but buckle up, and let's wade into the deep end of what's really happening in your old North State.
Welcome to another edition of Civitalk. This is the 20th episode. I'm here with Donald Bryson today. A little bit more on that. Brooke is out. But we're going to talk North Carolina 9, the congressional district that's still up for grabs. We've spent a lot of time making fun of Florida and other states because they haven't, you know, they hadn't made a decision on some of their elections. Well, here in North Carolina, we are last. I mean, we're first in business and a lot of great things, but when it comes to deciding elections, we look like we may be last in the union right now. But we're also, again, we'll look at some of the previews for General Assembly and kind of just at the outset talk about Christmas and maybe some Christmas tidbits we Donald and I have from our past. And Donald, I wanted to ask you, you are the president and CEO. What does CEO mean? Does that mean if you ever get fired, you're leaving with hundreds of millions in stock options?
If only we had hundreds of millions of stock options. You know, I've joked about that since I started, that I was hired as president and CEO, but I'm not sure what you get with CEO that you don't get with president. So I don't actually know what that means.
You're right. I was just wondering that because I saw that on some of your titles, president and CEO.
But, you know, I have seen in other organizations, larger organizations than Civitas, where they have a CEO and then they'll also have a president. But, you know, we're not big enough to quite need two different people to do that.
Right. So let's talk a little bit about Christmas. I don't know if you have any Christmas traditions. I have a few. I think one of the things for me growing up with Christmas is my dad was an Air Force pilot, and I was in a lot of different places at Christmas. I mean, I remember spending a Christmas on Waikiki Beach when we moved to Hawaii. I remember spending Christmases in Cairo, Egypt. I was in Hawaii for the 50th anniversary of Pearl Harbor for one Christmas, and we had a family photo taken out and near the monument. And Egypt, I remember doing a Christmas family photo at the pyramids and stuff. So a lot of my Christmases, I remember just kind of being in some cool places and being in some different places. I don't know if you have any cool Christmas stories or traditions you'd like to share with our audience.
I don't have any cool Christmas story. You know, I never went to Egypt or Pearl Harbor. Although I will note this was the first year, I believe this was the first year that they had the Pearl Harbor Memorial on December 7th, that none of the survivors were there anymore.
Wow, yeah.
And so that was, you know, kind of a hallmark or a landmark year for that memorial. But my, you know, I came from a small town. We're a bunch of rednecks. We can't help it. And so Christmas always had to do with fireworks with me.
Right.
And so, you know, in small towns, and I see it here in the Raleigh area too, you know, around the 4th of July and closer to New Year's, you'll have these people set up tents everywhere and sell fireworks. Well, for whatever reason, my family never got together with the larger family at New Year's. We got together at Christmas. So we shot off a lot of fireworks at Christmas. I've never seen or heard anybody else doing that, but that's what we did when I was a kid. I always looked forward to that.
I think one of my, this is kind of funny, when I was living in Egypt for Christmas, I had a Super Nintendo, and I had like a, I was never a big gamer, but I was into some of the football games and sports games like baseball and stuff. And I remember getting a Tecmo Super Bowl game on Super Nintendo, and I got it that morning, and the next day we were flying out to Kenya to spend Christmas in Nairobi as a family. Yeah. And I didn't want to leave. I begged my parents. I was like 13 or 14. I begged my parents to allow me to stay home and not go to Nairobi and do a safari and all that. It's just funny how you are as a kid sometimes, and ended up being one of the coolest trips I've ever taken in my life doing a safari over in Nairobi. But it's just funny is that I would have, at that time, it tells you how dumb you can be as a kid sometimes. Sometimes the kids are really smart. Sometimes they can be really dumb, because I remember begging my parents that I'd rather spend a week playing Tecmo Super Bowl or Tecmo Bowl or whatever it was called on the Super Nintendo than spend a week in Nairobi, Kenya.
Hey, man, you couldn't stop Bo Jackson in the Tecmo
Super Bowl. That's true. That's true.
He was a monster.
Yeah, there were several running backs and position guys that just had a huge advantage. They were like almost superhuman. So let's jump into North Carolina 9, because I think it seems to be dominating the discussion across not just the state, but really a lot of the national politics is focused on North Carolina 9. There's been, you know, in our hyper-politicized culture, there's a lot of predictions about what's going to happen. There's going to be a new election. Do you think there's going to be a new election, first of all? Because I think that's one of the big questions. I mean, it certainly appears that way.
Yeah, I think everything is sort of heading towards having a new election in the 9th Congressional District. The question, I think, is will there be traditional primaries for each of the parties, or will the, let me rephrase that, will the parties have the options of having primaries again on top of a general, or will it just be a general? I think that the General Assembly and the bill that they passed yesterday, they're leaning towards trying to have more primaries again, but this is a new area of election law I've never even seen before, so it's hard to see who has what authority to certify what election. It's very strange.
It seems there could be some confusion in the media, too. I saw a CNN article. I don't remember the name of the article, but I think if you just Googled North Carolina 9 and CNN, it's the latest CNN law was saying that it had to be that the U.S. House of Representatives would have to call for the primary. I don't even understand how that works, but they cited that because North Carolina already certified the primary that they couldn't go back and uncertify it. But
so, hold on, you mean CNN may or may not have gotten something wrong?
Yeah, I know. Who knows? I don't know.
Stunned.
But they're the only ones that I mean, I read, you know, at least half a dozen national articles on this, including local ones, and they were the only ones that mentioned that aspect. So I don't know if it's true or not, but, you know, something after the show I'll look into. And if you know, then certainly tell us and comment on that. So...
Leah Byers on the Civitas website put together a great article called "What We Know About NC9 and What We Should Have Seen Coming," and she goes back and historically talks about at least in 2016 claims of election fraud in the 9th district, particularly pertaining to Bladen and Robeson counties, complaints from the Pat McCrory campaign about what happened in Bladen County, so complaints from Republicans about Bladen County. Now that we have complaints about Democrats about what's going on in Bladen County. I would really urge you to go. We'll put it up below. If you're on Facebook right now, we'll actually put it up below the video link. But I urge you to go onto the Civitas website and take a look at that article because it provides a lot of context that you're only getting in bits and pieces at a time from the news right now. And she lays it out very, very well.
Yeah, that's important. I read a New York Times piece this morning on just sort of an overview of North Carolina elections. And, of course, the New York Times perspective was that we've only had election problems in the state primarily since the General Assembly changed power. You know, it's kind of a funny, and they did go back in a little bit of some problems in the 70s, but most of the sort of narrative of the article was that this is a new phenomenon, that we're having all this problems with elections in North Carolina. Of course, we all know that's not the case. If you've lived in the state for a while, there's just a lot of you know, a lot of conflict and a lot of corruption that has happened, not just in election law but in politics, that certainly transcends you know, one party. We had one party rule for so long, so it certainly transcends just sort of a short snapshot in history where there are some problems.
Yeah, I also saw in the press where somebody was trying to distinguish that this isn't voter fraud. This is something else. Well, yes, in a sense, this is not necessarily voter fraud. Voters didn't misrepresent, or you know, somebody didn't come in and represent themselves to be someone else.
Right.
It wasn't the voters that had the problem. It was someone who created fraud by possibly just dumping a bunch of ballots. Allegedly is what has happened. So I suppose it's election fraud. Nonetheless, like the fact that it took up an entire article on CNN to talk about this is sort of silly that, yes, this is illegal and this is a problem. We need to figure out what exactly happened in Bladen and Robeson County, for that matter.
Yeah, I think one of the things, just me thinking about this issue and what's happened in North Carolina 9, and in California too, I mean, you saw the speaker, Paul Ryan, talked about, you know, I know ballot harvesting in North Carolina is illegal. We look like we've seen some of that happen in North Carolina 9 in at least two of those counties. But I think one of the things that's happened in California is you've got ballot harvesting, which is essentially legal in the way that we understand it here, is that we've moved away from this sort of one day, one vote model. And I think that is creating some problems because now elections are bleeding more and more to sort of policy and sort of the partisanship of political policy that we see in our politics on such a daily basis. So for me, one of the things that I'm having a little bit of trouble with is that now elections are being spanned out so long. A lot of people are making fun of McCrory's comments, and I defended him a little bit when he said, oh, maybe it should just be for military, absentee should just be for military voters. And certainly we can work that out a little bit and expand that a little bit. But I think he has a point in the sense that the more people involved in elections and the more it becomes this giant process, the more I think it becomes politicized. So in some ways, I think there's a lot of things that we can look at with a one... No, I'm not saying this should be the way we do it in North Carolina, but I think when we move away from this one day, one vote model, essentially just having a vote on election day, we kind of set ourselves up for more corruption. We set ourselves up for more problems. And I think that's something we have to think about when moving forward about trying to solve some of these problems.
Well, we've changed the way that we talk about vote by mail, and then in-person early voting in North Carolina. In-person early voting in North Carolina is, in fact, early voting.
Right.
But vote by mail is technically called absentee, or they're absentee ballots. And North Carolina is one of the states that is a no-excuse absentee ballot state, which essentially means that that voting by mail is early voting.
Right.
Right. But there are states that you have to provide, or at least historically at some point, had to provide a plausible excuse. I will be out of the country. I will be out of state. I won't be there on election day. But we've taken away the need to provide an explanation for that.
Right.
And so, anybody can vote by mail.
Yeah, and I think it just sets up problems if you just have anybody voting by mail. And I'd be interesting to see some of the solutions to that problem. I mean, I would like to get back, even if you made voting a national holiday, I'm not saying I'm for that, but I would love to get back to a little bit more of a tighter model when you say just a little bit less early voting, and maybe most of the voting happens on election day. I know that can be a problem in some places where there's crowds, so you may need to mitigate that factor, but I think there's still a lot of credence to that model. And so, just for me personally, I think there's a lot of benefits and value to that, is sort of just coming out voting and then, the election certified within less than 24 hours. It is a much clearer perspective in that sense.
I think that's right. And some of the, I don't know that sanctity is quite the right word, but the importance of election day. And we focus far too much on, or not too much, but we focus far more on presidential elections than we do midterm elections,
right.
Or even municipal elections. And so, you had a lot of counties. I think there were 17 counties back in the primaries earlier this year that passed bonds. You're talking about millions of dollars in bonds that were determined by, in some counties, 12% of voters.
Right.
That's problematic, and it's because, as a society, I don't know how to fix it, but as a society, we don't put enough attention on the actual voting part of it.
Right. Yeah, I think you're exactly right. Let's jump into previewing the 2019 General Assembly. There's obviously some changes. Republicans lost their supermajority in both chambers. Donald, what do you expect to see in 2019? What are going to be a few of the big issues voters and just constituents and citizens across the state should be looking out for?
Gridlock.
Yep.
So as everybody who listens to this podcast probably knows, but I'll go over it again. Republicans have lost enough seats in both the state House and the state Senate that they have lost their supermajorities. So they're no longer going to be able to have just enough Republicans to override vetoes by Governor Cooper, which now makes Governor Cooper far more relevant in the legislative process. And so they're going to have to find ways to either make deals with Governor Cooper, they being the Republican leaders in the General Assembly, are going to have to either find ways to make deals with Governor Cooper, or they're going to have to find ways to make deals with Democrats, or with enough Democrats in the General Assembly to override those vetoes. And how that plays out, nobody can really see. But one thing that we can be sure of is that Democrats desperately want Medicaid expansion through Obamacare, in North Carolina, and that will be up for debate. The scary part about that, if you're a conservative, is that Democrats in the General Assembly now have 55 seats, and there are about 7 Republicans who in some way or another have indicated they would vote for Medicaid expansion, which gets you to a majority of the state House that would vote in favor of Medicaid expansion. So what will the Senate do? What will be the Senate's play? Or does the leadership in the House find some sort of way to block that vote? Do they knock some of the Republicans off? Or in fact, some of the Democrats not on board? Medicaid expansion is going to be a big debate next year. You're going to see a continued debate probably about these corporate incentives, which we've talked about
right.
at length at Civitas and on this podcast. Are we going to continue to play this game? Are we going to try to beef up our incentives programs, make them even larger and bigger? Are we going to go down the road of South Carolina, who actually has taken on debt? They've actually bonded out debt to be able to pay off some of these incentives to these big corporations. You're going to see a continued debate about school choice, because now that is no longer necessarily a partisan divide. You're starting to see more Democrats, particularly urban Democrats, come on board with school choice. So, at the point that you have charter schools with massive waiting lists, you have the education savings accounts programs program in North Carolina with a large waiting list. There were only 300 spots, and 1,500 families applied for those spots. Mm-hmm. You have the opportunity scholarship program with a waiting list. Do legislators try to find a way to forward fund and increase funding and maybe even increase the eligibility for those programs going forward? And then last but not least, and probably not even last, there are a host of other topics. What will happen with the state budget? Will we increase spending more than we have over the past few years? Will that be the key bargaining chip with Governor Cooper? How long will the budget debate go? We don't really have a fiscal cliff situation in North Carolina where if they don't pass a budget by June 30th, which is the end of the fiscal year, then the current spending levels just continue on. They passed that into law about 3 or 4 years ago. But at some point, we do have to actually pass a budget. And so how long do the budget negotiations go on? They're supposed to be done by June 30th, but will it go into July, August? Will we be here in October? I don't know. We'll see. That'll be the big thing to watch as we go into the session.
I'm really interested in, just because Cooper's obviously just I mean, we can say this from our polling, Cooper's been very popular to some extent in North Carolina, even though he's probably a little bit more mid-pack if you look at the governors nationally and their popularity. But I'm interested to see, you know, how effective he is in sort of implementing some of his agenda with still Republican majorities. It'll be interesting to see how many Republicans are willing to cave, so to speak, on some of his agenda, where they're willing to stand pat. So to me, I'm just very fascinated because I think there's been this, and we talk about this at Civitas, but there's been this narrative that, you know, North Carolina has been governed unfairly. And I think you see that from some of the national media flyover stuff, and that, you know, the General Assembly's gone rogue, so to speak. So I'm interested to see how that narrative changes, how much of Cooper's agenda is he able to incorporate. He's obviously, I think, well positioned in some ways on education. I mean, that's, you know, that's been a winning issue for him. He's certainly betting the House to, you know, his house, so to speak, on Medicaid expansion. And I think he'll probably he'll make a big push there. So I'm just fascinated to see how much of his agenda will he actually get done. Will he be frustrated to some extent? Will he lash out if he's not getting his way? I think it'll be interesting to see. I think that you know, he's got a lot of, so to speak, at the moment has some political capital, but will he be willing to lose it to fight for some of his policies?
I think that's fair. I think the National Democratic Party, and for that matter, the North Carolina Democratic Party, is pushing Cooper further to the left than he is probably comfortable going. And that could really come out on the issue of education funding, where he's got this Leandro Commission to determine, you know, what would be appropriate funding or appropriate funding levels for public education in North Carolina due to the Leandro lawsuit back from, what was that, back in the 90s. It's a very old lawsuit that's still ongoing.
Right.
And so if they ever have, I believe, what's called a collusive decision on that, a final decision on what are the appropriate funding levels, you know, we might have a situation like Kansas or California where the court orders the state government to increase revenue. And so we'll, you know, you would have court ordered tax increases. And, you know, is Governor Cooper comfortable with his commission coming out with that sort of finding? Will that make him uncomfortable? Is that too far? How much funding is enough funding? You know, if they want us to spend on the level of Massachusetts or New Jersey or something like that, you're talking about bankrupting the state, essentially. We'd have to have massive tax increases. You couldn't increase the personal income tax and the corporate income tax enough to raise that amount of money, because then you're going to have to start talking about, you know, implementing a state property tax or increasing the sales tax enough to Tennessee-like levels at 9%.
Right.
It's just, who knows what in the world's going to happen out of that. But it's interesting, how far is Cooper willing to go down that rabbit hole?
Yeah, I think that is a big key because, you know, he's obviously primed real well, I think, to get some of his agenda passed. But it'll be interesting to see how, to me, the General Assembly responds to him. Will he compromise in some keys, or will he play kind of the political game that he played before when he just didn't have a lot of power because of the supermajorities and just sort of lecture people that didn't agree with him on the political side? So we've got time to do this. Let's shift to this Apple announcement that just happened today. You know, if you're listening on the radio, you've probably heard about it for a couple of days, but let's shift to the Apple announcement. There was a story in WRAL saying that North Carolina politicians were surprised that they didn't get this headquarters, and that they sweetened the deal to have Apple come to the Triangle region. And to me, this is an issue, I think, where the General Assembly and the political leaders in North Carolina can really band together and set an example nationally, be national leaders and not part of the herd on this sort of corporate incentive stampede that everybody seems to be chasing. It's almost become like a sick joke to some degree. But I'm just interested in seeing I think where our leaders, if they take principled positions on this going forward, or they just continue to be a part of the herd? I mean, do you have any thoughts about this, Donald, about this recent announcement and sort of corporate incentives in general? Do you just want to share with us? I mean, that's a big part of the Civitas mission.
I could talk about corporate incentives for days. This Apple announcement, I'll be honest, I was surprised. I actually thought, I didn't think we would get Amazon, but I actually thought we would get Apple.
Yeah, I did too.
North Carolina, you know, every state says that they're becoming a tech center, but North Carolina legitimately is a tech center.
Right.
You know, I think in terms of the number of tech jobs, we are, you know, person for person competing with Silicon Valley at this point. And we have a major tech presence out at RTP. IBM's here, Citrix is here, Red Hat is here. Lenovo, we always forget about Lenovo. We actually make computers here.
Yeah.
And there's a large tech presence. Not to mention Google Fiber has already moved in. We're one of those metro areas where they're moving in. But nonetheless, you know, okay, we didn't get Apple. I kind of shrug and say big deal.
But that's a big cult, you know, corporation, you know, that Apple and stuff. One of the coolest things I saw, I wasn't a big, when I did live in Grand Rapids, they have this thing called Art Prize, and somebody did the Apple logo with all these people sort of bowing down to it and stuff, and it was a pretty cool painting, and I just remember not being a huge fan of some of the sort of modern art and Art Prize, but I love that. So it has, I mean, it obviously has a huge cult following, one of the biggest corporations in the world. So, you know, I think there's more of almost a personal loss with this one, with some people, certainly in the triangles. Like, you know, Apple's just that iconic corporation.
It is probably a personal loss to some Apple fans, people who have, you know, signed the blood contract with that cult. But, and I say that tongue in cheek, obviously.
Yeah, and I like Apple products. I actually switched a few years ago, and so, you know, we joke about it, but, you know, they are a little user friendly once you finally figure out how to use them. It's kind of ironic, I guess, but
you know, North Carolina's economy is very healthy. We've seen massive wage growth, a decline in poverty, a decline in child poverty. Our unemployment rate is below 4% at this point. You know, if Apple came in and created 500 jobs, 5,000 jobs, 9,000 jobs, whatever it is they were supposed to bring, are they really creating jobs in North Carolina? Or are they bringing in more people and adding to the population? Or, and part of this would actually have been the problem, are they actually stealing talent from other homegrown operations here in North Carolina? And you know, that's something that I've continued to point out about the Cooper administration. And every party has been guilty of this, of buying into these corporate incentives where we set aside separate, you know, special tax incentives for this company or that company. But, you know, what does that say to the homegrown companies? When Governor Cooper gave, what was it, I think $22 million in incentives to Credit Suisse, a Swiss-owned bank, to expand an RTP last year. What did that say to Bank of America and BB&T and the Bank of Granite and First Citizens Bank, all those homegrown banks that have expanded with a pretty large footprint but started here in North Carolina and have not received those incentives? Does that mean that those jobs are less important, or was it just more important for Governor Cooper to be able to, you know, cut that ribbon? And I think there's a ribbon in scissor addiction down at the General Assembly and at the Governor's Mansion.
No doubt. And I think I blogged about this today on our website, but U.S. News and World Report actually wrote a very fair, balanced piece. They talked about some of the harm the incentives will do to the region. And it talked about really that Apple, this is one of the reasons we're for getting rid of the corporate income tax, is because it creates level fairness for all entrepreneurial endeavors and not just big corporations. But one of the things they pointed out was the lack of affordable housing and how this could exacerbate that situation if you brought in somebody like Apple, because people are being priced out of their houses because of, you know, if you don't have a big high-tech job in this region, you may get priced out of your home or you're having to move. And a lot of people moving in for other jobs can't afford the, you know, big housing costs in this region. But also, I mean, just the loss of revenue for some of these local governments, you can't make that up, even with, you know, even with a big corporation coming in and some revenue coming in because of that. I saw that they're going to they would basically not pay the corporate income tax for 30 years.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a big loss of revenue.
It's a massive loss of revenue, and they get, you know, not just, you know, corporate income tax abatements, they get direct incentives back. The state will cut a check based off of a certain percentage of the personal income tax that they would have created by bringing all those jobs in, you know, if they actually do that. And then there, you know, is property tax abatement. So, you know, yes, the property value has gone up in the county, but you have a county that is having to put in all the infrastructure and the road maintenance
schools,
and that sort of thing, and schools, who are getting nothing out of that property tax, even though the property is now worth, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars.
And I think this is the reason why there's a lot of folks on the right and the left who are on agreement on this issue is because, I mean, look, you've got middle class, sometimes lower middle class or upper middle class people subsidizing rich corporations and subsidizing the rich employees that are coming in for these jobs. So obviously, if you're for fairness, if you're for transparency in government, this is not something you're going to cheer and applaud. So I think that's an encouragement that there are folks, you know, across the ideological lens that can combine on this issue. And it's really people of principle. I mean, we disagree with a lot of people on the left, but if they're willing to be principled, there's no reason why we shouldn't work with them on this issue. And I think there's a lot of opportunity to do that.
Absolutely. You know, the tax code should be applied fairly. And these incentives don't apply the tax code very fairly, and this is where you know, conservatives and you know, far left progressives can come together and say, hey, you know, if we think that low taxes will create jobs, well, then let's just lower taxes, or at least not treat these other people differently. Then we can have an honest conversation about what is the appropriate tax rate, what is the appropriate spending level. But until we get all this crazy stuff out of the tax code, which includes these incentives, it's difficult to have that conversation.
No doubt. And we're going to keep on this issue at Civitas. This will be one of our most important topics, just focusing on corporate incentives, because I think most citizens across the state recognize unfairness when they see it. So they want somebody out there fighting for them, and we're fighting for them on this issue, and we'll continue to do that. I mean, in some ways it's an uphill battle, but it's also, I think, an optimistic and promising battle, because I think a lot of people just see through the nonsense and just want fairness. I mean, I think it's an issue of, you know, if you're an entrepreneur, you don't want to be subsidizing some big corporation. You don't want to be losing resources. You don't want to be losing employees to some big corporation that's being subsidized by your government that you pay taxes to.
Or subsidizing your competition.
Exactly. I mean, it's a huge issue. So we're going to close out here in a couple of minutes. Let's focus on the weather. Donald, I'm so happy to be in North Carolina. I love the state because I lived up in Grand Rapids. I moved up there in the summer, but when the winter came, and you may have not heard about this before, I don't know how far north you've lived, but I had to scrape ice on the inside of my windshield. I had never done that before, and I lived up some places in the north. I mean, I lived up in New Hampshire, and I had lived up in Michigan previously as a child. But as an adult, having to scrape ice on the inside, not the outside of your windshield, is pretty demoralizing. So I'm really happy to be here in North Carolina. What do you think about all the snow we had recently?
I was really surprised. Of course, apparently I was right on the line where in northern Wake County, up here around where the Civitas office is, we had like 7 or 8 inches of
right.
snow. My yard, however, was just a mud puddle. But, you know, it was indicative of what the year has been for North Carolina. I believe that since the creation of the RDU airport, this is the fourth wettest year in total that airport has had. It's just been a really, really wet year. Typically, winter is a drier part of the year for, you know, central and eastern North Carolina. But it appears that it's just going to continue to be wet for a little while.
Yeah. And wet is hard to deal with sometimes, especially if you have little kids like Donald and I have that want to go outside, and you can't have them always going outside all the time. But do you have any weather prediction? Do you think it's going to be a really cold winter? Because I'm not a big fan. Having lived in the cold tundra of Grand Rapids, I'm not a huge fan of cold weather. I don't know if you have any predictions about, will it be a cold winter, a mild winter? I think it's tough to say. I think the Farmer's Almanac, again, said it's supposed to be a cold winter. But I don't know if you had any thoughts on that. We've already had a little bit of fairly cold weather, but certainly can get worse in North Carolina.
Yeah, I don't know that we'll have like a super cold, bitter cold winter, like a polar vortex kind of thing. But I'm not going to be surprised if it snows 3 or 4 times, which is a big deal in North Carolina.
Yep. So today we talked North Carolina 9. We talked General Assembly predictions and corporate incentives. This is something that we'll remain focused on here at Civitas. We appreciate our audience out there. Donald, any last parting word for our listeners?
Glad that you're on. Listen to Civitalk. Why don't you go online? We're going to have a way for you to subscribe really soon. But check out our website. I really urge you to go back and read Leah Byer's article that I talked about earlier in the show about NCO9, about you know, what's happened and what we should have seen coming, and you know, what are the potential policy implications of that going forward, because that story in the 9th Congressional District just is not going to go away anytime soon.
Yeah, and if you enjoy this podcast, consider supporting Civitas. I mean, we love to have you as a listener, and if there's ever an opportunity that you can support us, we would really appreciate it. We want to keep this podcast not only going, which we plan to do, but we want to grow it. We want to have additional resources to promote it. it to draw in more listeners. And with great listeners like you, we know we can do that. So we appreciate your support and we appreciate your time. As always, signing off, this is Ray Notstein with Donald Bryson. Keep with us next week. Bye-bye.